Welcome to Write Through the Roof, the podcast for writers who want to improve their craft. I'm Madeline Diaz, and in this show, I'm interviewing writers of all different types and asking, what's that one thing that took your writing to the next level? So come and join me and learn all the proven tips, tricks, and techniques to take your writing right through the roof. Through the roof. My guest today is Karen Warren. How are you going, Karen?
Oh, I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. How are you?
Very good. It's a public holiday here today, so that's fantastic.
Public holidays are always good.
Yes, exactly. A little background about Karen. So Karen Warren is an award-winning writer of horror, science fiction, and dark fantasy. Her novel, The Grief Hole, was the first Australian novel to win the Aurealis, Ditmar, and Shadow Awards. She's based in Canberra, and later on this year she's headed to Baltimore as a guest of honour at the World Fantasy Convention. Thanks for coming on the show, Karen.
Oh, thanks so much for inviting me.
Not a problem. Okay, so how I like to start off is a few kind of warm-up questions, limber up a bit, so a few sun salutations, some, you know, down-faced dogs. So you're a short story writer and you also write novels and novellas, so what is your favourite writing medium?
I love them all, actually. I find different values in all the different lengths. So I actually like even doing flash fiction, like a 50-word story or a 100-word story, because I think you can just explore the concepts and ideas in different ways in each of them. I'm really enjoying the novella length at the moment, though, having said that, because you've got room to explore, but you don't have this pressure to have quite as many layers and quite as many pathways as you need to have in a novel to make it readable. So, yes, but maybe the novella is my favourite at the moment. But I really enjoy all the different variations.
So what kind of length do you classify as a novella?
Something over 15,000 and up to probably 40,000, I guess. Yeah, I'm just working on a Frankenstein-inspired one at the moment that's about 16,000 words. It's considered a novella. But I've done others that are, I think Sky was about 30,000. So, yes, I think something going up to around about 40,000 words I would define it.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah. So do you have any writing rituals?
You know, I don't really, and I was thinking hard about this question. I don't think many people really have the freedom to have an actual ritual. I think if I waited until all the circumstances were exactly right, I'd never get anything written because I've got family and other jobs and, you know, there's so much else that goes on in your life that I feel like I need to take the chances when I can. My ritual is that I don't have a ritual. You know, turn the computer on and try not to waste too much time on social media and that sort of thing. But even about writing place and writing time, I really did find, certainly when the kids were younger, that I could not hold myself to say, oh, well, I have to write in this place at this time because I'd never write. I have to snatch the moments. It might be, you know, catching the bus is a five. That's where I do my writing for the day. That sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So yes, I don't really have any particular ritual, but apart from making the most of the time and place that I have.
Well, that sounds like it's a good place to be. So no matter where you are, you can, if you've got that spare time, you can crack some words out.
Yeah, well, just not having that the privilege of space, I suppose, and just accepting the fact that if I waited for the perfect time and the perfect place, I really would never get anything done, and I had to stop using it as an excuse to not get any words out. Mm. Yeah, because I think that's very easy too to try and find excuses for why you can't do something, but you don't get your novels written that way, do you?
No, not at all.
Yes.
So if you don't have any rituals, do you have a writing fuel of choice that helps you out?
Well, I like to go and make a hot drink of some kind because that's sort of an excuse to get up and have a bit of a stretch and whatever. So, yeah, nice coffee, a bit of soup. I'll, you know, have a nice bit of soup to warm me up in a cold winter day. Try to avoid snacking on chips and lollies and things because, you know, it's just all too easy when you're sitting there on your own to just and not actually focusing on the food that you're eating to end up eating packets and packets of things that you shouldn't necessarily be eating. Yeah. So, yes, the hot beverage. And I'll make a chai. I'm pretty good at making brewed chai, so I'll make a nice pot of that at some stage in the afternoon and, you know, try and sip away. And I find that is really that's a good seems to inspire ideas and gives me a bit of energy and that sort of thing. It's probably the sugar in there, but my daughter and I are saying that there's the cardamom. It's good for a concentration.
Mm. Oh,
yeah.
Good.
I know, it'll be true enough, but we've decided we're going to say it's a thing.
Oh, if it works for you, go with it.
Absolutely.
Okay, so it sounds like we've got to know you a little bit better and about your process and no excuses, but a bit of chai.
Yeah, no excuses.
So you write horror and science fiction and dark fantasy, but how do you describe your writing and what themes do you like to explore?
I look at the darker elements of humanity and why we do what we do. And these are always the stories that have presented themselves to me and always the ones that I've been interested in. Even, you know, from about 5 or 6, I was reading fairy stories but really being fascinated by the darker, nastier ones like Bluebeard and those sorts of ones where the nasty things happen and sometimes there's redemption but not always redemption. So I think I'm exploring all of the stuff that makes us human, love and loss and all the different variations of family and what family means to us and how some families can be damaging but some families are wonderful things. I'm really fascinated by the afterlife and what comes next. So I do a lot of ghost stories and exploring the nature of what happens when we die just because it's one of those great questions of our lives, isn't it?
And so much to explore there.
Yes, yeah, and all the different variations, all the different. This one of the stories I'm working on at the moment is called Crisis Apparition, which is about this idea that when people are in very deep crisis, they can actually send their spirit out to look for help elsewhere. So they leave their body and they go out looking for help. Whether or not that's true or not, I don't know. But it's a very fascinating idea. So it's about the family. It's about the fear of death. This, you know, quite deep fear of death that a lot of us have because we don't know what's coming next. And you know, is this the only life we've got to live? So all those sorts of things, really, and yeah, back to human behaviour as well, and why people do what they do, why some people want to care for the people around them, and other people don't want to do such a thing.
Okay.
Mm. Oh, yes, lots.
So what was there any particular inspiration for that crisis apparition story you were just speaking about?
Yeah, I think I like reading little ghost story books and it was mentioned in one of those. Someone sort of mentioned in passing that they saw a crisis apparition and just the combination of the two words really strikes me. That's quite often where an idea for a story will come from is just an odd combination of words that really sparks something in me. And I think it was in that same book or another ghost book at the same time. There was a ghost photo. I love looking at ghost photos as well, most of which you sort of look at and go, no, I don't think there's a ghost there. But, you know, sometimes there's something quite chilling about them. And this was one in a very old house that had a spiral staircase. And the ghost was a woman who was clinging on to the banister and basically looked like she was dragging herself up the stairs. And so I just had this image of a woman who something had happened to her and she was dragging herself up the stairs. Her crisis apparition was dragging itself up the stairs to try and seek help. So, yes, that's where that story started.
Fascinating.
Yes. It's amazing. There's things that just spark. It's hard to explain something, what happens, but something just fires in my brain. And that's when I know a story's about to begin, when those little combination of those things and an instant image and an instant understanding maybe of what the story will be about. Then, of course, there's the hard work of putting it down on the page and figuring out who your characters are and all that sort of thing as well. But the inspiration and the feeling of it can sometimes come in a flash like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So in your writing career, what do you think has been the most helpful thing to improve your writing?
Well, I know what most people probably say, and this is what I agree with too, is practice, just keeping at it and keeping trying, reading and seeing what other people are doing. But one of the things I think is true too is that finding belief in myself is something that's helped me improve, like trusting in my own processes and my own words and trusting that I don't have to write like other people in order to get these words onto the page. And I think that once I gave myself that permission to write in my own way, I think that I improved then as well, because then I could really more so develop my own voice. And partly that came from even the smallest of writing successes, somebody liking a story or selling a story and starting to have the confidence in my own work. And then just keep practicing and keep writing. Because I think that's a hard thing to find, isn't it? I don't know if you've found that as well, just having the confidence in your own words is a good stage to get to in your writing career, I think. And then once you've got that confidence, then you can really build on your own practices and your own work.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm quite there yet, personally, but, it's that trusting yourself. I think that's probably something that I would need to do a little bit more of.
Yeah, well, not that I always do. Like, I'm always doubting myself as well and feeling like I haven't really cracked this and haven't done that right. But then I just do draft after draft after draft until I feel like I am actually finally there. Mm. But, yeah, just that initial belief in yourself that you can actually do this is, I think that was when I really did start to really start to improve my writing. Mm.
Okay, excellent. Good advice. So,
yes.
So are you trying anything new, any new techniques at the moment? You were talking about more novellas. Is there any kind of writing advice or something that you've been trying or different style or anything?
I don't really do techniques and that sort of thing. I guess I'm always playing with the way a story is told. So all of my novels most of my novels don't really have proper chapters. They're just told in different variations of episodes, I suppose. So the one most recent one that I'm doing the final edits of at the moment is told in a diary form, going back over a couple of hundred years. So it's people over just the last 200 years and their diary entries. And that's nothing brand new at all, but it was certainly a different way for me to be telling a story, because I had to make sure that each of those, and there's about, I think, 50 or 60 different entries, that each of those entries had a distinct voice. And that was quite a challenge. They each had to be to tell part of a story in a clever way, I suppose, and not an obvious way, and they all had to have their own voices because it was all these different people writing their own diaries. So that was very challenging but fun at the same time, having to switch from character to character and figure out what their angle on the story would be.
Mm, especially in first person.
Yes, that's right. And each of them, and figuring out what each person has a different agenda really and what they're trying to present, and thinking about not only who they are as who they really are, but how they want to present themselves to the world as well. So the public face versus the private face. And so, yes, that was very challenging, but it was a really, really good way to do it, and such a good way for my main character, who's sort of the central to it all, it gave her more depth as well, because I was seeing her from lots of different angles. So I think it really helped me round her out as a character as well.
Did you know enough about the characters before you started, or do you find that the characters emerge as you write?
They mostly emerged as I wrote the story. The main character, I knew what the end result was going to be for her, so I knew what sort of person I needed to develop her into. The other characters really just I knew when they were born and how old they were, so that helped me develop a little bit about their character. But the rest of it just came through in the storytelling. And a little bit they played, they had to play certain roles, so their characters fit the roles that I wanted them to play to a certain extent. But, yeah, a lot of it does develop in the story, and I think you can't be restrained by your initial idea of what you think your character is going to be like, I think. You have to be a little bit open to how it might develop. This one, the Crisis Apparition one, actually is a really interesting case in point. Because I thought I was making this main character as a male character. I really thought he was going to be a very unsympathetic character and a real bad guy, but my readers are really feeling a lot of empathy for him, which is good. I'm kind of pleased, but it really shifted the way I ended the story and shifted the way I sort of told the story once I realised that I'd really created this character that people felt for. I had to try and tell the story a little bit differently. I had to let him be a better person than I thought he was going to be at the beginning of the story. It's interesting.
So do you have a little team of trusted readers, do you? Or?
Oh, well, this one is the editor who's buying the story and is it one trusted reader. I have a couple, but, yeah, it's tricky. It's hard to find people who don't want to put their own story into your story. Isn't it? You know, they how they would write the story. So I do. Yes, I'm a bit fussy about my beta readers.
It is.
They often have their own agenda of what they think a story should be, and it can be very hard for them to step back from it. Mm. So yes, I do have my little team of trusted readers, and I've got a couple who aren't writers either. I think that's a really good thing to have. People who love to read but don't write, so they're commenting as readers rather than writers, and I think that's a really important thing.
Yeah, I think there's some quote from Neil Gaiman that is, if you have your beta readers, if they tell you it's wrong, then they're probably right. If they tell you how to fix it, they're probably wrong.
Yeah, right. Yes.
So it's more about the, oh, that bit didn't work for me.
Yeah, that's right. And not, yeah. But I mean, I suppose, when you're edited, like when you work with an editor, they will often, to me, I don't totally agree with his comment there, because I think that often an editor will tell you how to fix something or what they think. So sometimes I say, oh, this doesn't work, what can you fix it? And sometimes the fix just appears to them and they say, well, this might work. Mm. So, yeah, I'm not necessarily against somebody else telling me how they think it could be fixed. Just depends on, you know, and they write and they're not, they could be right and they could be wrong. You never know. Mm, so I don't think there's any definitive rules in anything to do with writing. I don't trust any rule that says it is this or it is that. I think everything is just what it is and each circumstance is different.
So, all right, well, let's talk a little bit more about reading. So your own reading. So what writers inspire you?
Well, I've always loved Lisa Tuttle, is a writer I've read for a long time, since even before I was being published. Just an incredibly intelligent and brave, amazing writer. Scary stuff and really human stuff. And, yeah, I just really love her. Steve Rasnick-Tem, who I mentioned before, was one of these writers who's just the most, you know, absolutely terrifying in what he's doing, but so bright and intelligent and so layered. I really, really love him as well. William Golding, I've always loved William Golding. Just he's one of those ones I go back and reread if I'm feeling any doubt about writing in the sort of way I write, which is a little bit outside the box. I don't write in an ordinary way, and I go back and read him and realise that he really writes outside the box as well. Just, you know, interesting ways of telling a story and brave ways of telling a story. Yeah, and that's just a couple. I'll do read a lot, and always have read a lot. So, I'm inspired by the good stuff as well as the bad stuff, but I much prefer to read the good stuff. And the brave, I like stuff that's really takes chances, I guess. Too, I get bored with stuff that I know how it's going to end, and it just seems to follow tropes and follow a routine. I'm inspired by stuff that takes chances and is a bit braver. Alasdair Gray is another one, and Scottish writer, not Spanish. Spanish. A Scottish writer called Alasdair Gray. I just absolutely adore him. Wonderful artist as well as an amazing writer. Lots.
Cool. Okay, so before we started, we were talking about some books that you have coming out, and one of them you spoke to me about was a new short story collection. Which has the lovely title of A Primer to Karen Warren, which must be a privilege to have that.
I know. That's just amazing. So, yeah, that's from Dark Moon Books. He's doing a series. The first one actually was Steve Rasnick-Tem, who's one of my heroes, and he's also doing Lisa Tuttle, who's another one of my absolute heroes, so that's pretty incredible, and Jeffrey Ford, who's another writer I just absolutely adore. I just absolutely love his work as well. So it's five older stories that Eric, the editor, has selected, and one new story, which is the crisis apparition story I've been talking about, then a biographical listing of all the work, which is this incredible listing that he's done, And then I've written a little bit of an autobiography. It's a bit of a confessional, actually. I'd say stuff in that piece that I haven't necessarily spoken about very much before, about the various things that have inspired me as a writer. So I think that's probably going to be interesting for people to read. And an essay on my work, which is a bit daunting and amazing. So, yeah, it's a gorgeous, it's an amazing series that he's setting up. I think he just wanted to have things that really went into the craft and the themes and really looked in depth at some of the work of some of the writers he liked. And I was very lucky enough to be one of them.
So how was writing that autobiographical piece? Was that something different for you to play with?
Yeah, it really was. And I just, I think partly it was because I think Eric had changed such faith and trust in me that I really wanted to put myself more onto the page than I probably normally would at a personal level. So, it was good. It was good. And he just asked me for an autobiography, and he said, oh, you got up to 3,000 words. And I said, well, I can't just write about my writing life. I can do that in a couple of hundred words, otherwise it gets boring. So how about I tell you about some of the stuff that actually made me a writer, that turned me into a writer?
Can you give us any sneak peeks there?
It's a little bit about my religious background, so I'm not going to say any more than that for now. For one thing, we were taught transcendental meditation when I was very young, from about 6 or 7 or 8 years old, and I found it really, really boring. I hated it. And I would have to sit there quietly in my room for 20 minutes and they would take all the books away from me and I couldn't read, and I just really had to sit there. And my way of meditating, I guess, is to think of stories and characters and dialogues and all that sort of thing. So that's a little element of it. I don't like being bored, so partly it's about me filling the gaps of being bored, yes.
Well, that wasn't what I was expecting at all. No, I thought you were going to talk about some supernatural experience you had as a child or something.
No, being forced to do transcendental meditation.
So you've got a couple of things out. Is there anything else that you're working on right now?
Just doing the final edits on my new novel, which is coming out through Omnium Gatherum, and we're still finalising the title of that one. But it's set in a time ball tower and with people who have been given eternal life. Criminals who have been given eternal life are locked in this tower, and some of them are 200 years old, some of them are a little bit newer, but they're all not having a very good time. So that's the diary entries of various people over the 200 years who are looking after these criminals. I actually just was in South Australia just the last week, where there is a time ball tower in a little town called Semaphore. So I went to that little town and it was a fascinating place, right on the beach, but amazing history there as well, and took some cool photos of this old tower. I'm just imagining what was inside it.
What is a time ball tower?
Well, they used to drop them. They used to be for navigation for people out at sea, where this ball gets pulled up every day. And I think the time differs, but this one that I saw that gets pulled up at 12:57 every day and dropped at 1 o'clock. And so that people out at sea can know that is the time at 1 o'clock. They can sort of set their clocks and that sort of thing.
Oh, okay.
I know. They're very odd. They don't need it anymore, obviously. But yeah, they were very important at one stage. But I'm really quite fascinated by these things that were vitally important once and are no longer. Now these towers just kind of sit there and they're not needed anymore. But at one stage they were vitally important. Yes, fascinated by all those bits of equipment and machinery of things that we can't even recognise what they are anymore. But they were once, really, really important life-saving items, I suppose, or very useful items. It's even things like old telephones and all that sort of things. It's quite fascinating of things that were once vital and are no longer so. They're now just curios.
And it makes you wonder how the item feels.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, really. Well, I suppose people can be the same way too, people who... great leaders and or whatever, and then they get old. And I think that's partly what I'm exploring in this novel as well. It was partly inspired by visits to old people's homes, you know, and they're all in their little rooms and they're different people. They're not recognised as the people they were when they were younger. Mm. They're all just old people. And some of them, you go there and there's just a little photo on their door that's supposed to sum up an entire life. So some will have a photo of a ship or some will have a photo of a cat or their beach house they used to go to. And that photo sums up an entire existence but is only really a memory of that existence. They're just considered old people altogether. So that's partly what I was capturing in this story, is this idea of people just lined up. Yeah, it's a bit sad, really. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that you don't really like, you know, don't like to talk about, but I find them very affecting.
Absolutely.
And a friend, yes. And how people, if you knew that person when they were younger, then you remember that person. But if you only meet that person when they're older, then that's the person you see as the old person who can't quite look after themselves as well as they could once upon a time, and how that's how we judge them.
Mm.
Yes.
Very thought-provoking.
Yes, yes. And so with my criminals mostly, I was trying to present them as they are. So they've all done horrendously terrible things, which I do hint at throughout the novel, but I didn't want to focus on that. I really wanted to focus on them being as they are there. So you get this different idea of them. They're not the young murderer they once were. They're now just a husk of something, which is something else altogether, even though the intent is still there and the guilt is still there, but the body has changed.
Wow, you're inspiring all kinds of thoughts for me. I've got to get out my little ideas book, I think.
Oh, good, good, good. Well, that's wonderful. Oh, that makes me very happy. To me, that should be what reading is about. You read something and you have a notebook right there because it sparks off all your own little ideas and things that you want to do.
Absolutely.
So that's good. I'm very happy to hear that.
All right. Well, I might wrap up and let you get back to your writing because I know, as you said, you've been away for a week, so you've probably got a whole bunch of edits there waiting for you to get stuck back into.
Yes.
But before...
Yes, and I'm also reading for the World Fantasy Awards this year.
Oh.
So that's masses of reading as well. So I need to do editing, but I also, yes, which is a very big job, but a wonderful job to have as well.
Yeah, I can imagine. If you've got like stacks of books all around you.
Yes, yes. Now, my dear husband actually went and bought me a new bookcase because he likes. I think that was his way of saying, can we not have books just stacked everywhere? But he, rather than fussing about it, he just went and bought me a new bookcase, and now they're all sort of stacked in the bookcase. So it's a very successful shopping trip, that one.
a good supportive husband.
I know. Isn't that good? Yes.
So before I ask where people can find you online, I just wanted to say that I read The Grief Hole earlier this year or later last year, and I actually had to stop a few times because I just found it just so overwhelming, and just some of the actual grief involved in the book. So, yeah, I just wanted to say that.
Yeah.
I found it very affecting.
Yes. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, well, I guess that part of that was really about not using that grief to make people sad just for the sake of telling a story, but really making us feel something for those characters. And I guess it does bring up feelings of your own grief when you're reading it too. But I've had people say that they feel it was redemptive by the end, and people who suffered losses who actually found it hard to read through but then did find that they felt better at the end of it. So I think that's really interesting.
Mm.
Yes, yes. Now, it was a hard book to write, but like with any of those, anything that you're writing that's dark and considered a horror or dark fiction, you can't hold back, otherwise you're not staying true to the story, I think. So I don't think I could have softened any of those edges in that story. Mm. It wouldn't have been the same book, definitely, and it certainly wouldn't have been my book. I guess that's one of the things I was thinking when I'm saying earlier about finding the confidence to have my own voice. Part of that is staying as dark as these stories are that I intend to write and not softening them up, because a lot of people would rather have a slightly softer story, but the story I really need to tell is this much harsher story that I then inflict on the poor reader. So sorry about that.
it was a great experience, but it was harrowing at times.
Yes. Oh, dear. Sorry about that.
You're not really sorry, are you?
I'm not really sorry, no. No. I'm happy.
All right. Well, I'll let you get back to your reading and editing. So if people want to find out more about you, where can they find you online and where can they find your work?
I do have a WordPress page as Karen Warren at WordPress, and I'm on Twitter as Karen Warren. So mostly, and I do go on Twitter a bit. I'm really slack with updating my web page. I need to do it more often. But they get either of those places. And, yeah, get in touch with me via Twitter if you wanted to do that.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out to talk about your dark little musings.
Yes, my thoughts.
It's been really fun.
Look, thank you so much, and thanks for your insightful questions.
Oh, no problem. Today's tip is a book recommendation, or rather in my case it was an audiobook. The book is How to Publish Your Book by Jane Friedman, which is available through the Great Courses on Audible. While this podcast focuses on writing craft, I'm currently at the querying stage for one of my novels, a historical fantasy called The Women of Wasps and War, and so I've gone back to revisit this book to sharpen my dodgy querying skills. And while you may not be at the querying stage, in episode 20, Caroline Mitchell talked about how she writes her hook and her book synopsis before she starts a new project. So you might find this helpful while you're still in the writing trenches. Now, in How to Publish a Book, Friedman takes us through 24 lectures on the process of getting published from both a fiction and a non-fiction perspective. This is for those writers who are done with the manuscript and ready to move from the art to the business side. She starts off talking through understanding your genre and your audience, to then to the process of finding an agent, a publisher, an editor, sharpening your pitch and your query letter and your synopsis. She explains contracts and the need for marketing and building your author platform. Friedman also tackles the interesting subject, when to self-publish, a controversial topic indeed. Are you being impatient? Is self-publishing really for you? Is your market too niche for a mainstream publisher? And this book also helps with what to expect in the publishing process and, importantly, how to cope with rejection. Now, for me, this is one of the best all-in-one resources I've found on publishing, and Friedman also has a brilliant blog where she discusses the state of the publishing nation and often posts updates as publishing industry changes. So if you're ready to start the publishing process, I recommend you take a look at How to Publish a Book by Jane Friedman. Thanks for listening to Write Through the Roof. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe or spread the word by writing a review on your listening platform of choice. And if you'd like to get in contact with me, please go to madelinedst.com or madeline_dst on Twitter, no apostrophes. You can find the show notes for this episode on madelinedst.com under the Write Through the Roof tab. And until next time, what are you going to do to improve your writing this week?